If the deaths of Barry and Honey Sherman aren't the most suspicious in Canadian history, they are on the shortlist.
Shocking news from the business world tonight. The founder of Canadian drug giant Apotex, Barry Sherman, and his wife Honey have been found dead in their York Mills mansion. Police are treating the deaths of the billionaire philanthropists as suspicious.
The circumstances surrounding the Shermans' deaths were strange from the very beginning. But in the weeks and months that followed, they got even stranger.
We believe now, through the 6 weeks of work review, we have sufficient evidence to describe this as a double homicide investigation.
It's now been almost 2 years since their bodies were found. The case is still open. The police are still working it. Tips keep coming in, and reporters keep digging. One reporter in particular. A new book reveals some of the details of the case that police have been tight-lipped about, and more importantly, it sheds light on just how secretive police have been. It also gets at why answers to two of Canadian crime's most baffling questions, who killed the Shermans, and why, might actually not be that far away. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Kevin Donovan is an investigative reporter with the Toronto Star. He is also the author of The Billionaire Murders, The Mysterious Deaths of Barry and Honey Sherman. Hey, Kevin.
Hello, Jordan.
Why don't you start with where this whole story started on the day that Barry and Honey Sherman were found?
December 15th, 2017, almost 2 years ago, a realtor who was showing some people through a house on Old Colony Road in North Toronto came upon a scene in the basement, a swimming pool area that was rarely used by the Shermans. And it was Barry and Honey Sherman. They had, as it turned out, been strangled. They were posed in a semi-seated position, is how the police have described it, with leather belts around their neck. They'd been dead for probably close to 36 hours.
And what was the initial reaction of the police and their investigation?
I wasn't involved until early January in this, but was aware of what was happening. The police never came out publicly and said it was murder-suicide, but by the Saturday, all the major media outlets were reporting police sources were calling this a murder-suicide. In fact, one outlet the night before was going to publish a story saying they were executed. It was a double murder. And the reporter has written about this and said that he got a call saying, no, this is a murder-suicide. And certainly court documents that I've accessed in the process show that in the first 6 weeks, the police were investigating the murder of Honey Sherman, but not the murder of Honey Sherman and Barry Sherman.
So how did you get involved and start your investigation?
My editor at The Star on January 6th asked me if I would look into the case and find out two things. One, who did it? Still working on that. But the other easier task was to see if this was a murder-suicide or a double murder. And having been a reporter for 35 years, I have a number of sources that I've built up over the years. And also just with some shoe leather, was able to track down enough people and interview enough people to do a story a couple of weeks later that had the quite bold headline, "They Were Murdered." That was on January 19th, almost just over a month after the deaths. And then the Toronto police read that story, saw that I had named a forensic pathologist who had come to this different conclusion than their own people. They called Dr. David Chase on up, asked him to come in for an interview. And then within 2 days, they were holding a press conference. The police held a press conference, and they announced that it was a double murder.
How does it happen like that? Like, how does the course of event? That's not usual.
I still have so many unanswered questions on that. One of the things I write in The Billionaire Murders is that particular week when the Sherman bodies were found, we in the public didn't know about the Bruce MacArthur investigation by the Toronto Homicide Squad, but it was very active at that time, and they were really closing in on him. It is possible that resources were quite correctly applied to the MacArthur case, and then the Sherman case was originally handled by divisional officers. They looked at the scene, and until we actually get an opportunity to talk to the investigators who were on the scene, it's not going to be clear why they came up with that assumption. One of the issues was in the first pathologist had noticed that a bone in our neck called the hyoid bone was not broken, and there are those in the forensics, like everything, journalism, law, there's always a vigorous debate about about what things mean. And when the hyoid bone is not broken, it can be a sign of suicide. And if manual strangulation, a much more violent attack, normally breaks the hyoid bone. Interestingly, that is the same issue going on with the Jeffrey Epstein case in New York.
Right.
It's the second time in my life I've heard of the hyoid bone. And so the second pathologist that was brought in by the Sherman family was Dr. David Chason, who's the former chief pathologist for Ontario. And he had done a paper 20 years before on the hyoid bone and knew that it was not necessarily indicative one or the other. And he also noticed markings on the wrist that looked like the Shermans had been bound but then unbound after death. And he put all that together and made his findings known to the Toronto police. And then they started a proper investigation, but 6 weeks had gone by.
What happens in those 6 weeks when they're investigating it differently?
Well, I mean, they were on a bit of a, in my opinion, a tunnel vision, the Toronto police. They were looking at things like Barry and Honey's medical records to see if they were depressed. And they were also, they were gathering the correct information, for example, video surveillance from Apotex. Barry Sherman was the founder and owner of Apotex, generic drug firm. They were gathering that surveillance video. They were gathering video from across the street from the Shermans. Shermans had no cameras, but a neighbor did. But they didn't look at them. And they didn't look at them until after my story came out in the Star and after the police made the change in diagnosis. So time was lost, absolutely. And then going ahead many months passed before they began taking DNA and fingerprint from people to exclude them, people who were with the Shermans that day, for example.
So the case moves forward after it's determined that there's at least the potential that they were murdered. That's still a long time ago. What happened over the weeks and months and more than a year now since then? The case is still unsolved.
Yes, and the police have been, they've assigned... There's a permanent officer on the case, and the Sherman case is different than a lot of other homicide investigations at this stage because it's very much a, I'll call it almost a paper or a data exercise. The police have been conducting searches, not searches where somebody goes in and into somebody's house. These are production order searches where they're asking telecommunication companies, all sorts of organizations that keep data. You know, we're all tracked these days. And they're not sharing with me which data they are accessing, but they have done this over 40 times now, and there's more that are being sought right now as we're talking. And they're doing this to try and, I believe, hone in on a person or persons. The police have said during some of the challenges that I've mounted on behalf of the Star to try and get information, they have said that they have, quote, a theory of the case and, quote, an idea of what happened. They will not say whether they have a suspect, but I can't imagine having a theory and not having an actual suspect or at least a person of interest. So they're working away on it. They have this one officer, Detective Dennis Yim, who works on it full time. Then they have two other officers, Christy Devine and Detective Sergeant Brandon Price. He's the main officer on it these days. And they are, those two are in the last month working on it on a daily basis, which is quite a change from last April when they were not as involved. Something is moving forward on this case. And when I was last in court with the police to obtain some information related to the search warrants, they said they are, quote, cautiously optimistic. And that was in response to me asking, you know, are we getting any closer? And they said, yes, they are.
Tell me a little bit about the dynamics of this case between the police and the family. You kind of touched on it by mentioning that the family had their own pathologist.
Yeah, Jordan, it's quite unheard of. The family was very upset that first night because even before the media broke the story of the murder-suicide theory, they were hearing things. And it's an interesting story of how Brian Greenspan, who's a criminal lawyer, and his private detective team got involved. And that's because on the Friday evening when the day the bodies were found, the Sherman family received a call from a family of another Jewish couple who had been murdered in Florida in 2013. And that family was still looking for answers in its case, but they had hired private detectives in Florida to help them. And so the Sherman family were advised by these friends to do the same. So that's how Greenspan got involved. And Greenspan, I think, made an important contribution to this by bringing in a forensic pathologist to do as Brian Greenspan called it, to provide a second lens on the case. That was a key thing. There's no doubt about that. And I'm convinced that had that not happened, this case would have gone down as a murder-suicide, even though the family was upset. They needed somebody to look at those bodies before they went into the ground, which happened the day after the second set of forensic autopsies.
So since then, they've been running parallel investigations?
They have, but I don't think it's that valuable anymore. The Toronto Police have said that as of July 2nd of 2019, they've received 343 tips that the family has passed on to them. Those tips include at least one psychic, and I have a feeling more psychics have passed on information to Greenspan and his team. On a weekly basis up until July, the family was sending USB keys of these tips, and the tips are, as far as I understand, they're voicemails, they're email information from people, and there's lots of people out there who are, because I receive a lot of this too, who are telling me that, you know, the Clinton Foundation rubbed out the Shermans, or Mossad did it. There's lots of theories like that, and I believe that the police would prefer at this stage to not be getting all this information, because that, I think, is probably slowing them down, because they feel they have to check everything out.
When you're investigating an ongoing case like this, how usual or unusual is the level of information you've been getting from the police?
Well, the only information that anyone's gotten from the police has been through these times when I've gone to court. I've done it four times now, and I'm allowed to cross-examine the detective on the case, because he is trying to prove that they shouldn't reveal anything. I actually have gotten a fair bit out of this process, and it's led to front page stories in the Star. I find this very unusual that we're not getting information, and it's been very difficult and frustrating, because I've been quite critical of the Toronto Police. I'm sure they have answers to a lot of the allegations that I've raised, but they don't feel like they can answer those because they don't want to jeopardize the case. So it must be tough to be on their side and seeing these headlines
indicating
that they messed up. It's difficult. But I think the world is kind of going that way. There's less information coming out from authorities who are investigating criminal allegations, and that's because they always know that at the other end of a case is a defense lawyer that might want to tear them apart for anything they said to the media.
It does seem, though, with a murder, or at least deaths like this, they're incredibly high profile. There was intense media attention at the time that it occurred. And the case is still unsolved, and we don't get regular updates. You mentioned the MacArthur investigation. It was a good example of times that police would, at the very least, whether they were right or wrong about their theories, continually address the media and the community and say, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, they're just not. And they've been very reactive. There have been stories that I've done that raise specific issues. And one of them came after a TV reporter had re-canvassed the area of the Sherman's home when the house was knocked down. And he had knocked on the door of a neighbor across the street and heard the story that a man on the Thursday, so the day in between the death on the Wednesday and the discovery of the bodies on the Friday, and they had video surveillance that they had passed on to the police saying that that showed that a man had come and knocked at that door that Thursday morning. And they looked at the video before giving it to the police, and it looked like the man was actually going in and out. Key bit of information, one would think. So I got onto that story, interviewed the couple, and produced quite a very important story on this. Gave the police 3 days. Can you respond? Nothing, nothing, nothing. Story comes out, and then Chief Mark Saunders gives a press conference saying not much, but he says, oh, we checked into that. We know who that person is, and we're not going to talk about it. But he had the opportunity to say that for 3 days before I did the story. So my point is they're very reactive, and they're very sensitive about this too. They want, I think the Toronto Police really wants to show that they got their person in this, and they still are a distance from the finish line.
What about the Sherman family itself beyond their investigation? There have been a number of names thrown about. How complex is the web inside Apotex and that family?
Well, it is complex. In some cases, one thinks of the TV show Succession, where there's a second generation and everybody's trying to take control. In the case of the Shermans, Barry was 75, Honey was 70. Barry was still very much active in his company, running his company and his private holding company, which is called SureFam. The only one of his four children that was interested in the business at all is Jonathan, who is his son, and the three daughters. One daughter is Alexandra, is interested in the charity, and in fact, she's running the family charity right now. But the other two, who are the oldest and the youngest, do not seem interested at all. That's kind of laying out the web there. Honey and Barry each had a sister. The sister of Honey is persona non grata in the family. She's been just told not to come around anymore because of some comments she made. And the children are at various times getting along with each other or not getting along with each other. It's a very dysfunctional family, and I think it always has been. One of the things I learned in the process of reporting on this is that Barry maintained really strong ties with the children of his family, friends. And there are a number of children who are adult children that he would say to them, maybe you should take over the company. Come work at Apotex. He didn't see this in his own children. He seemed to like other people's children more than his own.
Do we know how the estate would be divided? I'm imagining that's one of the things that would be looked into in a case like this.
Yeah, that's a good question. The will, Barry Sherman's very simple will, which he wrote in 2013, is subject to a seal, and we're challenging that now at the Supreme Court of Canada. My sources, and I have three sources who have seen the will, say that it's divided equally amongst the four children. That would be from the eldest to the youngest, Lauren, Jonathan, Alexandra, and Kaylin. So they have the split. There's money for his wife, Honey, if Barry dies first, but it's to be kept in a trust, which it's been explained to me was to be sort of controlled by the estate executors. There's also a page that deals with his the extended family, the children of his of their two sisters, of Honey's sister and Barry's sister. And as I understand it, there's money for them at the pleasure of the executors. There were four executors of the Sherman estate. Now there's only three because Jack Kay, Barry's longtime, one of his best friends, longtime almost co-pilot at Apotex, has just been removed from it after he was fired by Jonathan from Apotex. So Jack Kay is not involved anymore in this. And then there's the three trustees, which are Jonathan, one of the sisters' husband, and a longtime CFO at SureFam, the family holding company.
How do you wrangle something that has as many threads as you've just described for a book like this when the case is still open? And like theoretically, the cops could have come forward last week as your book was about to be published and say, guess what? We solved the case.
Yes, and there were some days when I was feeling like I was on tenterhooks and wondering if that was about to happen. I mean, it would have been a good thing for justice if that had happened, but it would not have been as good for me. But the way I've laid out the book is a very simple way that all the odd-numbered chapters are contemporaneous to the investigation and things that I learned in between 2017 and now. But the even-numbered chapters start back. The first one starts back with Barry Sherman and his best friend, Joel Alster, in Forest Hill Collegiate in 1955. And then as we move forward in the book, he gets older and older and has more accomplishments and some setbacks. And then the investigation, the same issue. And then at the end, it all the timelines match up.
To use the same term you used earlier, do you have a theory of the case?
Well, I do have I have theories of the case. I'm not going to talk about them here, but
I tried.
No, it's a good try, and I want to make sure that I'm right before I say or publish anything related to that. One thing I can tell you is that I I'm obviously not a police officer. I've discounted all the international intrigue theories. I don't think it's a global firm getting back at Barry Sherman. I don't think it's one of his business deals gone wrong.
It's not the Clintons?
I don't think it's the Clintons. What I think is that it's people who knew Barry and Honey. I think it's people who wanted both of them dead and not just Barry. Barry would often say to people over the years, if anybody wants to take me out, I'm regular as clockwork. I work late at Apodex. I walk out. Somebody could just take a shot at me. He actually said that. And I also think it's somebody who knew a fair bit about their movements. It was unusual for the Shermans to both be home on a Wednesday evening. Barry on the Thursday really didn't have anything major to do. His basically desk mate for 35 years, Jack Kay, was away on the Thursday when their bodies were lying there. He's away in New York with his wife at something Honey arranged, a charity event that he was going to. And so somebody had, I think, that specific knowledge, and I think that's important to it. And the other thing, probably the more important recent information in this case, is that the police have just had the Toronto Police Intelligence Squad do a review and produce a report, which they just obtained now, from civilian analysts who have looked at what they referred to as a voluminous amount of data. And that data, I think, is helping them pinpoint location of individual or individuals. And so I think this case is very much live right now. And barring a setback, I predict that in the next few months, there's going to be a resolution.
What's your gut feeling about what happens once this case is solved to the company, to the family?
Well, I think it's going to, no matter what the resolution is, no matter who is ultimately charged, it's going to throw the family into a spotlight that they would like to stay away from. Because now, apart from the few of us in the media that have been doing stories about this and apart from this book, they actually have been able to get on with their lives. And so now there will be arguably one of the bigger trials in Canadian history, and it's going to take place in Toronto. And, there's going to be, all the top lawyers probably lining up to defend whoever is ultimately charged, if somebody is going to be charged.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Kevin Donovan, investigative reporter at The Star, and author of the new book, The Billionaire Murders, The Mysterious Deaths of Barry and Honey Sherman. If you'd like to hear more from us, we are at thebigstorypodcast.ca, and we are on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook at Frequency Pods, where you'll find us. You'll find The Gravy Train, which is the other podcast I host, and you'll find about a dozen other great podcasts part of the Frequency Network. You can listen to any one of them wherever you get your podcasts. That's Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, or what have you. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.